Welcome to Alan Steinfeld, also my program, New Realities. This is a part of, and I'm very happy to be talking again to James Redfield. Of course, he is the author of the fabulous bestseller, The Celestine Prophecies, which swept through the spiritual community as an awakening of who we really are and the energies that run through us. I mean, it was like a textbook for people in this community to start to realize that we're moving into a different realm and it's all about energy. So that was a galvanizing force in the 1990s, the Celestine Prophecies. And so it was the beginning of a crystallization of a spiritual culture in the U.S.
Without a doubt. And that culture is still there.
Yes.
And well, we're welcoming two more generations to it. And that's what's fun.
James, thanks for being here today.
Nice to be with you.
Do you want to just review the nine insights that you went through? I mean, if you feel like it, and then we'll go further to where you are. But, you know, I think they're worth reviewing because they were really key in our development.
Right. I'd be glad to do that. I think the book was very, very popular because, again, it was about steps or the recognition of insights that involve our sort of downloading of a higher consciousness.
Right.
And so it was a step. A step that I considered archetypal. I think that, I didn't make these steps up. The nine insights from the first book were something that I was reporting more or less because I was seeing these insights utilized. And they are very practical, but they're also elevating. And so I believe, to set the stage here a little bit, I believe the insights are archetypal in the sense that it fires up our brains, and what I did, as you know, is write a story about these insights. Right. So what was a story about?
Your gift was that you were able to perceive them and put them in a structure, of course, within a narrative to make them more accessible to people who just, like, all over the place saying this. And so you put it together in a really great, compact way.
Yeah, as a story, you know, you don't have to be just abstract. You can see this consciousness and the steps into a higher consciousness being played out in real time and the real settings and people trying it and losing it and moving into it again. So it's nine insights or nine archetypal awakenings that define humanity's growth in consciousness going into the future.
Yeah.
And they're really discoveries in terms of living life a different way. For instance, the first insight you'll remember is that there is this force that Carl Jung labeled synchronicity, which is a perception of meaningful coincidences. So what happens is that once you start to look and see these mysterious coincidences in your life, you realize you're being led someplace with these things. And what you're led to is a destiny, a sense of giving, a service to humanity, participation in the evolution of the world, right? So it's a fundamental to this pathway into consciousness is to grasp that we're being helped, that there's a force in the universe that is leading us somewhere if we pay attention. And that gets us out of just the scientific materialism. And if the world's, you know, the universe is dead and there's no spiritual meaning to it. And once you see synchronicity, you know that there's a spiritual design in this universe.
And it's beyond the logical mind. It doesn't make sense to people just in a left brain awareness. It's a mystery in a sense, but we're part of it.
That's right. Things happen and you have to find the meaning. You have to find this path in it within this mysterious coincidence. What's the information you're you're getting? How does it change your life? How does it lead you forward? So it's a kind of a investigation into your own journey in life. But it's pure proof that there's a spiritual dimension because it can be observed. So that's the basic number one insight. And all the other insights are about getting more of a flow of destiny about your life and using these mysterious coincidences to go through the opportunities they're presenting. And it makes life go easier. It makes our creative life more fulfilling. And there's a sense of destiny that goes with it that's very, very thrilling.
Talk about the creative life a little bit because, you know, I'm writing something, I'm struggling a little bit, accessing this. So how does that add to the creative flow?
Well, I think that, you know, we come here on it with a mission. And if you start right there, if the world is meaningful, then our lives are meaningful. And the key to, breakthrough high level creativity is knowing what you're here to create. So that opening to that memory, in a subsequent book, I called it a birth vision, you know, something that you intended to do with this lifetime. And so it's a very, a mysterious process. It all leads, though, to a sense of grounding in your own journey and watching these synchronicities. Now, there are other insights.
Let me just ask you one question about that, because even if you know what you're here to create, sometimes I find for me still hard to sit down and actually do what I know I'm here to do. So how do I get beyond that?
Well, it's interesting because we've re-released the Celestine Prophecy, and there's a reason for that. Millennials and their children, college students, are passing the Celestine Prophecy and other spiritually instructed books around like never before. So my publisher called me and I said, "Well, I'm working on another book." They said, you won't believe what's happening with Celestine. Millennials are passing it around like crazy, their children. So I've really started to believe that this is a new time in the world. You've got three generations in play. You've got boomers retiring, trying to figure out what they want to do when they grow up. You've got millennials reaching 38, which is that key astrological aspect that says, okay, I got the kids, I'm doing pretty good, I've got the job, I'm doing pretty good. Is that all there is? Isn't there more to life? Mm-hmm. Each generation asks that question around 38 to 41, because you see 40, you know, that's the big thing, right?
Right.
And at the same time, you have the children of the millennials approaching college, and some of them in college. And what do you do there? You're on your own. You go, oh my God, how am I going to get educated without spending a fortune? What do I want to do in life? So you've got three generations asking the deeper questions. And that's doing something to consciousness right now.
Yeah.
So what we did is decided to re-release the Celestine Prophecy. I wrote a long afterword, which I thought I would never do for this book. But I did because millennials are a little different. They apply everything. They're unifiers. And their children are highly creative. It's a highly creative generation, I believe. Now, they have to define themselves. I'm not trying to get ahead of them. But I believe it's a new time. Mm-hmm. So the creativity part has to do with the energy level, right?
Yeah.
Because there's a phenomenon that we can recognize as inspiration energy, right? And that's when we get going it with something we remember. We're exploring it. We're doing the background. We're researching. Whatever it is we're doing that awakens this inspiration energy. And that's when the synchronicities, if we stay in it, That's when the synchronicities. And I believe there's a way to stay in that energetic, creative modality. And I believe that it's a kind of meditation. And so I'm presenting in the workshops that we're doing, the events we're doing on this with this tour, a new kind of meditation. Now, it's a mindfulness meditation. But, you know, all of these meditations use a different mantra. You know, sometimes it's just seeking peace, that kind of thing. Or it's a word to occupy the ego, as you know. But what I believe is the amplifier of creativity is to stabilize your emotions. And the way we do that, in my view, is to download this love center. You know, the Hindus call it opening the heart center, right? But it's a focus on love, intending love, finding that love channel within you, because love is the natural best emotion that we can hold. And all the other lower emotions, when they pop up, if they're hitting, they can hit this love center, stabilizing force, and bounce off.
Well, some people say love isn't even an emotion because it is who we are. When we take everything away, what's left is love. It's like the sun is shining even though the clouds are in the way. So the sun's always, we're always love, but we're overshadowed with other petty emotions.
That's right. I mean, but whether you call it that, whether you call it just the basic centering process of our emotional center, you know, if you can get download this love, so that you, and it's not love for an object, you know, that's what we all think. Love, you have to love something, and love, that something brings love out in us, right? Okay, that's true, it does. But it, as when it becomes a permanent emotional state, that's when its power centers us in our, really, you become, I use this all the time, this kind of image. You become the star of your own movie unfolding in life, because it's a centering.
Right. But how do you get there? How do you find that center? How do you?
You have to practice it.
But
it's like everybody knows that it's a meditative practice that you do. You start with, if you can't do but 30 seconds, that's good. Start from there. But get to 20 minutes and do it every day. And you don't, the thing about this kind of mantra, you don't have to have your eyes shut. You can take your walk and do nothing but.
You're emanating the love field.
That's right.
Okay.
That's right. And it's the more you practice that, the easier it is, until all of a sudden, that's your core emotion, and it's a power that solidifies your journey in life.
Okay, that's good. Okay, one more thing I wanted to ask you about those nine insights is that the one that stands out also for me is the idea of taking energy. People take your energy or give you energy. It's a little vague because I probably read that 20 years ago. But
well, you know, it's the secret. It's what's wrong with humanity, right? We're cut off from our love channel. We're cut off from this connection, spiritual connection. And so we still want to feel in control of our lives, right? So what does the ego do with that? It starts to suck energy from people. I mean, we have this energy, and because we're cut off, we can't just give everybody all the energy they want to take. You know, it's hard. So that means there are power struggles. So you've got people who are power seekers. They're trying to dominate as many people out there as they can. You see,
because they feel unloved. Is that what you're saying? Because they're not feeling love. They're not feeling love, so they want to take love from others.
That's right. They take the energy, love-based energy, from others rather than open up to it personally. So that's what's wrong with the world. If everybody suddenly was practicing this meditation that I'm advocating, and suddenly enough to break through, so they have a download, they're open, they're centered, you can't take too much energy from them, right? And they, because we have enough to give, it's a source, So love is a source. You give it everywhere. And, you know, this is not just Beatles era jargon, right? This is a fundamental truth that one can prove to themselves, that you can find your center in life, and a peace, you know, the scriptures, Buddhism has, Hinduism, all the scriptures are the same about this, Christianity. You can find a peace that surpasses all understanding.
Yeah, no, I know. The thing is, sometimes you have to walk away, or, I mean, we have this unlimited source of love, but we can get drained because some people are a bottomless pit of need. And
well, yes, yeah. Right. You have to know how to conserve your energy, okay, while you're working on this.
Right.
So that's what the control dramas represent in the book. So part of the book, for those people who haven't read it yet, are about how to maintain your energy and center in a world where people are trying to use all these ways, passively and aggressively, to get you, to force you into either giving you their energy or take it outright by intimidation and all the rest, criticism. So it's, you know, there's a solution, of course, there, and that is to give energy all the time anyway, and name the game when you get into one of these control dramas. You know, there are two passive ones and two aggressive ones, and if you'll remember.
I do remember you saying
the most passive is the poor me.
Oh, right.
The person that when you walk in the energy field they create around them, you start to feel guilty. And they say things like, well, you know, I thought you would call yesterday and you didn't. And, you know, all these bad things happened to me yesterday, you know, implying that, you know, it's your fault.
Right.
It's not just a criticism, though. It's a kind of guilt trip.
So yeah, and it sucks out your energy. It's like most people want to be compassionate, so the poor me demands the energy.
That's right, and wants more and more because they have to have it all the time, so it's a habit.
Poor me is the passive way. Now, what's the other passive way? I'm just
the aloof. These are devices. You know, I mean.
Interaction
psychologists in the 70s and 80s had a ball with this, right? The games people play. Remember that book?
Yes.
So what I'm doing is taking this reality that has been described by the, you know, the real pioneers of the human potential movement.
Right.
You have to recognize it. The aloof, you know, you're walking into the energy field of around an aloof when you can't get a straight answer.
Right.
You know, you say, where'd you go last night? Oh, I went out.
I know.
Well, where'd you go? Oh, I went a couple of places, had a good time. No. So what's that? What's that distancing, right?
And they're also wanting you to, they want you to fall into their game. So it's another way of sucking energy.
Well, that's right. Because you have to, you know, where attention goes, energy flows. So if you give them attention, you're trying to figure out who they are. So you keep asking questions and they got the energy flowing, you know, and they'll always have some way to hook you, you know, some dramatic suggestion that what you did was really fun, but they're not going to give you the secret about it. It's a mystification process.
That's just as annoying as the poor me. I mean, we all do this unconsciously on some level too.
That's right. That's why we can't be too judgmental, right? Because we all resort to these control devices in order to feel better because we get attention, we force attention from other people. So we feel that. It would be a lot better. Think about it. It'd be a lot better if everybody just gave each other energy, right? Love energy, where you just gave it. So if someone's feeling a little low, you know, they just walk down the street. No, everybody's giving energy. Yeah.
Right.
So again, this sounds idealistic. Idealistically naive, but it's not. It's the secret for creating peace on the planet.
Mm.
Because if everybody came back to their own source of spiritual connection, They have this energy. They have this love. They practice it long enough. They walk with it. And that's when our creativity is amplified beyond belief.
Now, just go over, so we don't leave people hanging, the aggressive ways. Of
okay. The interrogator. Yeah, you know when you run into this field around a person, because you start to be nervous, because you instantly feel criticized.
Oh.
The person will say, well, wow, you look a little pale today. What's wrong with you? You know, or I can't believe you wore this to dinner. I mean, it's really not appropriate.
Or
other things, you know, like, you know, you really haven't. I would have expected you to have done more with your life by now, you know.
So it goes on and on. That's another way they suck your energy by defending.
Yeah, you have to, an interrogator, everybody watches because they feel like they have to be doing everything just right or they're going to get criticized, right? So they give all this energy to the interrogator.
You know, I had a friend who did that, but then they would flip over into like the neutral sense and then give energy. And this, when they had you, they would start to do that. And so,
it's everywhere. Everybody who's listening to this recognizes it in the world.
Right.
But here's the key point about this. And the last one, by the way, is the intimidator. This is the person who walks into a room and you just kind of, you know, they give off an air. Well, say the wrong thing to me and see what happens.
Right.
I'm about to go off here. I'm about to go off. So it's an aura that they walk in the room with and everybody starts to leave, which is the best thing to do with an intimidator.
Yeah.
They're the shortest, they're the most insecure, they're the most short of energy and the most desperate to force it out of you.
Yeah. The most demanding. Yes.
Yeah. So, but there's a way to get yourself out of these. Yeah. Okay. And ultimately, the source is to go within and open these doors to direct energy over time. But the first thing you can do is just try to take the conversation authentic. And the way you do that is that you name the game. In other words, if it's an interrogator, you say, you know, right now, as you talk, I'm really feeling criticized. Do you mean to do that? Oh, okay, what have you done? You've named the game, which means the game can't be played anymore, right? You do the same thing with all these other devices, these controlled devices.
You name the poor victim, you're being a victim again, and then they even for, you know, but then I'm being a criticizer if I call them a victim. So it's like...
Well, what you do is you just say, this is how I feel.
Right.
And if they want to argue or call you names or whatever, you just say, well, I'm just telling you how I feel.
Right. They can't
argue. You don't have to win.
Your feelings, because that's what you're feeling.
Yeah.
But the best way to be with people, I would say, yeah, exude that loving, even if they are one of those types, and be supportive of who they are, if we can.
That's right.
If
you can give enough energy to feel comfortable in the situation, that's what you do as you name the game, because you don't want to, because see, as soon as you name the game, the conversation goes authentic. Mm-hmm. Oh, okay. So let's clear the air. No more games. And now what are we going to talk about?
You see, this is what's so great about your book. It 20 years later, it is still valuable. It's still part of, I mean, of course, it's been here for thousands of years, the way people behave with each other, but it's still relevant. Even within a spiritual community awakening, because we've forgotten those insights, I think.
But here's the thing.
Yeah.
Here's the thing. They were insights. Mm-hmm. But now the world is, maybe even because things are so ugly in places out there in the world. Everybody's a little alarmed by that, right? And they want to, let's make it different somehow, right? And that alone, that decision, make it different somehow, elevates consciousness. And remember, like, these millennials and their children are already the majority population on the planet. So if they get this right, then we can move from just insight every now and then when we think about it to real ability. And all these insights, in my view, in an environment of higher consciousness, become abilities.
Abilities?
Abilities.
Like explain that a little bit.
Well, you know, it's an insight that synchronicity exists, right? Synchronicity, right. Meaningful coincidence, they happen to us.
Yes.
And the ability happens when you learn how to keep that flow of synchronicity going by investigating each happening for the meaning very consciously and very, very slowly. Mm-hmm. So each of these insights has a corresponding ability that we have to begin to use.
Ability or power, a way of empowering us, I think is another way of saying that.
That's right.
I see.
We you know, the world is designed, in my view, to be a lot less crazy than we're making it, okay? It's designed around, and here's another insight that's very important here. It's designed to be different. And the reason is and I think this can be proven to yourself, the karmic design of the world revolves around service and giving, okay? So here's how it works. We talk about this in the workshops until we can practice it. But it works this way. If you're a giver, if you think first about, well, how can I be a synchronicity for this other person before you ask, well, you know, where's my synchronicity from them? If you're trying to give energy, if you're trying to uplift people, if you're trying to do some service in the world, you're a giver. And if you're a giver, what happens? The karmic design is such that you draw more givers just like you into your life story. Mm-hmm. Okay. So people show up just at the right time to give you information that makes your journey clearer and what you want to do in life clearer. Mm-hmm. But if you're a taker, if you go, you know, well, how can I use this person? How can I use this person? How can I sell this person something they don't need, right? Which happens in this world every day, all over the place.
Yeah.
Okay. If you're a taker, guess who you draw into your life? Other takers. So they come in, and it's not for punishment. It's to give you a sense of what it feels like when you do this behavior. When you're a taker, when you get taken, you go, oh, man, that ruined my whole month. This guy misled me.
Like that don't even realize, if they're that unconscious, let's say, they don't even realize what they're doing, so they get caught up in that circle, and they're not awake to their actions.
That's right. So it's a benevolent universe. It's designed to reward giving, reward good service in the world, but it also, for the people who are takers, it operates to show them the error of their ways, you know.
Right.
And so and I'll just tell you, I tell everybody, this is something you can absolutely prove to yourself. It's like giving money. It's like tithing, not meaning the religious tithing, but the act of giving actually cash to people in need. You know, if you do that, it changes the financial flow of your life. And I don't want to sound like a televangelist on television.
No, but so you're saying if you give charity, whatever, you create a field that will have people give to you. Is that what you're saying?
That's exactly right. I mean, the giving has to be genuine, but it's important to know that it's rewarding.
Right.
It is rewarding.
No, that's not why people do it. They do it out of that sense of love and compassion and seeing someone's needs.
That's right.
You can help fulfill. So,
but you know, in the Bible, you know, they say, don't test God, you know, it's written in the Bible. Don't test God, right?
Uh-huh.
There's in the prophet Malachi, I believe is the one, he says, this is the only area you can test God. If you do good with your money, you can expect to be rewarded. Okay. And I think what that means is you know the system. Mm-hmm. You know, you're aligning yourself with the true karmic system of on this dimension, at least. Mm-hmm. And again, it's all about, you know, I can't send you the scientific evidence for this, but I can tell you if you actually do it, you'll be able absolutely to prove it to yourself.
Great. Now let's just move on a little bit. No, thank you for that. So you wrote the 9 insights, and then there was a 10th insight. And now, can you just, people want to read, they definitely want to reread the Silicene Prophecy just to catch up. And I know we're going to move into what you're working on now and how your evolution has built upon that. But what was the 10th insight again? I don't think
the 10th insight was, you know, this actually happened. I mean, people say, well, you're making these up. And I go, no. I'm writing down these principles because so many people are discovering them out there, and I can see it. It's happening. But, you know, after the Celestine Prophecy, the publisher says, well, you got to do another insight book. And I said, well, I can't, because an insight is when the collective consciousness shifts by some revelation that's entering the human mind in mass. You know what I mean? Right. So I said, I don't know what I could possibly talk about. Well, except during that time, and we're talking about 96 to 2000, mm-hmm. The great revelation was that the afterlife, the place we go to after death and we come from at birth, is a real place.
Right.
It's not, people blocked it. The humanity was repressed about what happened. They're so afraid of death, they couldn't conceive actually what happened. They knew the religious doctrine was you'd be okay, but heaven, what was that? What was that place? What's everybody doing? Nobody, they couldn't go there. Mm-hmm. And it was this mass ha-ha. That's when, you know, people start exploring angels and the real, you know, how do real angels act? A lot of movies out about angels. There was a lot of near-death experience research that began.
Right.
And I said, holy Moses, this is an insight. This is a collective insight we're having. And so that was my second book, The 10th Insight.
Hmm. Was that the life continues, this love feeling doesn't end.
That's right. We're eternal. We don't have to repress our lives, you know, and not even visit people at nursing homes because we can't stand the idea that we might actually be going to die someday. I mean, that's how repressed the world was.
Well, repressed. A beautiful example of that is Anita Morjani, A Dying to Be Me, was probably the most beautiful book about her experience of going to the other side and coming back and finding that love for herself. And she is such a great, do you know her work, Anita?
I do, yeah. I'm not widely read in it, but I know the name.
Yeah, no, she is just an inspiration for so many people. So that was the 10th insight, and you integrate. And you know, I have to say, all these insights are about, let's call it an ascension energy. We're at the portal to ascend, and it's about, you know, the fact that you name them, I think, is very important to make conscious of what's happening and to track our evolution as a spiritual culture, which is emerging in the West for the last, since the 60s, really, 1960s, but before that. But now there's a movement that the Silicene Prophecies were a big part of. So now here we are. That was 96. So here we are 20 something years later. Where you been? Where you been?
Well, let's just at least briefly mention the next two books.
Oh yeah.
I did an 11th insight, which was another revelation. I think was widely surfacing in humanity, and that's the power of intention. Remember what was that book?
The intention. Lynn McTaggart's work is big.
The power of intention. You know, Secret. The Secret came out. You know, the Secret was a big deal. The power. Yeah. You know, it was the trouble with the early versions of the understanding of intention is they didn't separate ego intention versus a kind of higher consciousness derived intention.
That's a good point. No one, I mean, people said, well, something wrong here. No one has pinpointed what is the problem.
Well, I can tell in the 11th insight, I talked about that. And then of course there was the 12th insight, which happened around 2012.
Okay. Was that part of
the 12th insight was a view of what the world would look like if we actually integrated all this awareness into personal life. Okay. Now I wrote that book and it's been still, it's out there, you know, bouncing around. Mm-hmm. And it, you know, the wave of that integration really, I concluded, was waiting on the next two generations to come into play. Because baby boomers are, we're abstract thinkers, okay?
Right.
We think all about this intellectual system, you know. Well, millennials are, they're integrators, I believe, because they don't think in terms of intellectual systems, you know, that you can debate, you know, while you're, you know, driving your gas guzzling car. You know, it's, they're integrators. They want life to go better, mm-hmm. but they want everyone to be okay in life. Mm-hmm. All right. Now there are other things that, you know, it was so, you know, the world's pretty crazy. And so millennials had a harder time in, you know, engaging, you know, in a career and all that. But that's because they needed to think in, you know, what's good for all of us. You know, how do we, they're like the World War II generation. If you remember, you know, they were unifiers. They thought of themselves as all together and believing the same thing, even though they didn't all together, but they wanted to have certain values that they all embraced. The same thing with the millennials. Mm-hmm. Now, their children, they are going to stretch the bubble some more like boomers did, mm-hmm. with intellectual ideas. But for now,
the children of millennials, you're saying? So there's the boomers, and after the boomers were the Generation X, or whatever you want to call them, and then the millennials, right?
No, the millennials are the children of baby boomers.
Oh, okay.
Because they sort of graduate high school at the turn of the century.
Okay, the I got you. Okay.
Turn of the millennium.
Reference, okay.
But their children, they're going to push the envelope. They want to discover new revelations about life, like much like the baby boomers wanted to.
Right.
But so this is a process, you know, it's like, you know, press the envelope and try to keep all the good things and throw out the bad. And then another generation wants to push the envelope and try new things in life. And then the next generation wants to consolidate this in a kind of a unifying mode. But so that's where we are. We're in a unifying mode. So talking to millennials, you can't talk abstracts. You say, well, how does this change the way I live? They want to know, well, how does this change the way I live and the way everybody could live? Mm-hmm. So that's the language I use out there right now, because it's a unifying world. We're all millennials in the sense, because they're the majority population, them and their children.
Right. So your next work, I mean, you laid out the groundwork, and now it's about unifying all these generations. And of course, what we're seeing in politics and all sorts of government in the world is a vast separation, though, too. It's drawing the divisions very clearly.
That's right. And hating the other side, you know, but you know, the people that do that, you know, each side thinks they're winning. Well, both of those sides are just two subgroups fighting, all right? And one group watches Fox and one group watches CNN, right? But the number of people watching is going down every year because right. everybody else is living their life.
Yeah.
And that's the big pool out of which progress will be made, out of that grassroots pool of people living their life in a different way.
So what is your solution in this next book and the re-release, but also in what you're working on now?
It's to speed up the breakthrough points in consciousness. Okay. So we're still spending too much time on our addictions and our coping devices. So we go back to, you know, we got to just have that chocolate cake or that fast food, or we have to watch movies. I won't say what kind, and, right. or we have to divert ourselves and just cover up this yearning in here because we don't know exactly how to do it. We don't know how to break through. And so I'm proposing with a new book that'll be out in a year and a half or so that we have a high-speed breakthrough to creativity that is very practical, and it's using this very mysterious symbol called the Enneagram. Mm. And a lot of people use the Enneagram in different ways, but the main thing is it defines our gift to the world. There's nine personality types. We're still very individualist within those, but there are nine major sort of types in terms of the kind of missions we're on.
Nine different missions, really.
That's right. And once you know those, it explains why all your friends are different, for one thing. But it also defines the gift of each side, of each type.
Was this a Gurdjieff thing, the Enneagram?
Yes. Gurdjieff, you know, is for everybody. This was, you know, he was an early 20th century mystic, came back from the Orient to Western civilization with this symbol called the Enneagram. It's a circle with a triangle within it and nine points
around
the circle.
Right.
And lines that go between the points in a particular way. So the thing, once you define your mission, you know, your heart's desire, your spark of the divine that you're moving, helping with, then you know how to recognize when you go backward on the lines of this Enneagram. You go backward to another, we're a blend, really. But you can go backward into your ego and know exactly what that looks like. Everybody else can know exactly what that looks like. So everybody knows where you're going backwards or how you go forward. Mm-hmm. And it's all very synchronistic how you go forward, because we meet people that show us their type, and we blend it a little bit into our own type. You don't ever abandon your type, but you the healthier you are and the more conscious you are, you blend more of the other types into your type. So it's fascinating the way it works. And
what's the name? What are you calling this new book? What are you calling it? The new book.
The new book, it's probably going to be I don't know what I'll call it yet, but it's going to be more of a direct sequel to the original Celestine Prophecy.
So do you want to go through these nine types, or is that too complicated here? Do you want to get
Maybe we can do that in another interview.
Okay. But just to say, these nine types will access the creative potential in each one of us when we discover which persona we embody.
That's right.
But sometimes when I've read about this is you think you're one thing because of your conditioning and your survival mechanism, and it's not going anywhere because that is not your soul alignment. So you have to undo the Enneagram you thought you were and find your true path.
That's right. That's right. You have to get your number correct.
Oh, right.
But once you do, it's a revelation. And I'll just give you one example, okay? I'm a five, okay? and you could call it personality type. I don't really like that. It's limiting. Mm-hmm. I really, it's a way of service. Mm-hmm. You know, it reveals my way of service. And a five is wants to reveal undiscovered information for the world.
Okay. I think so, I might be a five. Anyway.
So you probably are. Because a whole bunch of, a lot of people listen to this probably say, oh, I'm a five too, you know. Because we sit around in our cave, you know, and we're plotting and reading and experiencing. But guess what? A lot of fives, that staying in the cave is our primary coping device.
Right.
Don't want to get out of the cave, because then you would have to explain yourself. Because right. What short of energy, a five is unsure of what the discoveries are they're making and how to present it to the world. Right. Mm-hmm. Now get this: on the lines of the Enneagram, the five is shown to go to the eight. Now the eight is, you know, John Wayne was an eight. Eights are warriors. They're,
what do you mean shown to go? I mean, you're a five, and what does that mean? That,
well, if on the you look at the Enneagram and you say, well, where's the five? There's a line going forward from the five to the eight.
Oh, I see.
So for the five to be fully conscious and being able to operate in the world, they have to be more like an eight. So they have to download this eight energy as well. And eight are people who are eights when eight comes into the room, you know, they kind of suck all the energy out. They're very, I'm here. Yeah, what can I do? And they have an aspect of them that's something of a bully until they realize they have to give that strong energy to really actualize themselves. So the five, the five sitting around in the cave going, okay, I've got this information. This seems very important to get out in the world. But, you know, it's kind of scary to go outside the cave and deliver this in the world. But if they grow into eight, then they have that energy. You know, they have that energy. You know, when I first wrote the Celestine Prophecy, I had to go into eight because everybody wanted to hear about it. Correct? Right. Yeah. I once spoke to 26,000 people.
Wow!
Right? And now it seems normal, but it was a huge step of maturity that I had to take during that time. So,
but fives aren't eights. I mean, no. Eights, in order to express their eights, have to be something else. But, you know, there's
That's right. Eights have to go to two. They have to integrate two. And synchronicity brings all kind of twos into their life until they get it. Oh, I'm supposed to integrate some of that energy for me to be an enlightened eight. Because eights can be, like I said, bullies. You know, they force themselves on people. So every number has a downside, you know, an ego version and a higher self version. And you get to that by going to integrate these other numbers. So it's a bit of a map, but that's the key thing. You can see where you go wrong and what you have to do to actualize yourself at a greater level. It's a breakthrough technology.
But you're happy with it. Were you going to say?
Well, I'm really excited about that.
Okay.
I think it's going to be world transforming.
No, but I do want to say that the Enneagram has been around for, 80, 100 years. What's unique about your take on the Enneagram work?
Well, the unique part is that I define it spiritually.
Uh-huh.
Other people have done this. I mean, I'm consolidating a lot of work that other people have done in this. I'm not taking credit for all this, but I try to make it larger for people and show how it's helpful to break through to our creative power. That's the point.
It's all about creative power then. Your angle on it is to work with the potential of the personality and show how they could add more to the world. I guess that's what creativity.
That's right. They can live, they can fulfill their destiny in the world by knowing how to stretch themselves and actualize themselves by following the Enneagram. And they don't have to do it they don't have to follow somebody else to do it. They have to do these interpretations personally. So, and that's what the fun thing is about it.
But how do you work? How are you doing this tour, this like, you know, city tour with this? How will you work with people individually or in groups in this process? I'm just curious.
Well, I'm not really, what I'm doing now is laying a foundation for the work that would be made simpler with the Enneagram on board. Mm-hmm. It's not time to do that yet. What I'm doing now is talking about the breakthroughs in creativity we can find just with the knowledge we already have.
Give me an example of that. What do you mean? Which kind of breakthroughs?
Well, you know, most people have emotional outburst or emotional waves and cycles that hold them back from their creativity.
Yeah.
It's either, and all therapists know, everybody is trying to manage one of three emotions, either anxiety, kind of fear of the world, anger outbursts, which make you chop people's, go off and chop people's heads off, you know, with your language and your voice. And the third one are people are managing the hurts they think other people have done to them. Okay, those are the three whammies that hit people that hold them back.
Right.
So, but the solution happens in meditation. Mm-hmm. You can't just stop doing all that. That's an ingrained pattern. That's a coping device. It's something that is innate.
Right.
And you have to replace that self that gets whammied by emotions with meditation-based heart opening that stabilizes all these emotions. You can let those go. You can let those hurts from the past go. You can let that anxiety go because you replace it with inspiration energy. If you're inspired, you don't have any anxiety. And the anger outbursts same way.
But
if
how do you do that?
You're the center of your movie.
How do you do that? You mean people get into cycles, into patterns, they get downward spiral. How do you bring in the inspiration energy, the creativity into that?
Well, it's all meditation based. And that's the thing. You know, this is all very simple, but people have to realize that they have to practice letting these emotions go. Okay. And you do it in meditation. You let go of the chatter, the emotional chatter, the mental chatter, and you go back to the intention of a heart-opened love, okay? So you're intending love as a replacement for all these emotional selves that you have that hit you, all these problems. And there's no other way except to train yourself. As soon as an emotion, anxiety comes into your space, you let it go. And you come back to the intention of love. Okay. And same thing with anger and same thing with hurts, emotional hurts. You have to practice letting them go. And as soon as, if you practice that in meditation, let it go, come back, let them go, you come back. You do it day after day after day. But it absolutely, and I make this assertion all the time. It always works if you stick with it. It always works.
Well, I have to say, you're obviously someone who's practiced this. You know, can you just talk about your personal experience? Because you're sort of like a bodhisattva. You've dedicated your life to the upliftment of consciousness, and you've used your own self to what is the Dalai, clean the inside, you know, clean the junk out of, that's in the way. But talk about your experience in this, if you can.
Well, you know, I'm a living example that you can get over your fears. And, you know, five is one of the anxiety types. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's running from whatever reminds you of existential uncertainty in your life, you know, either about the world. And now, again, meditation was the solution for me. But see, this thing, you don't have to sit with your eyes closed. The meditation that I think works the best is that you can walk. Everybody needs to walk every day anyway. Walk, and every time some junk emotion or idea comes in, you let it go. You do nothing during that walk but let go of the crap that comes in, and build longer periods of time that you're focused on, you know, this emotion of, you know, this agape love without an object. You just feel it, do it, whatever it takes to feel it. You think about your departed loved ones, you know, you loved a little puppy when you were a kid, anything to remember what it feels like, right? Because it's hard to, you know, your grandchildren elicit love, right? It's all you have to do is look at your grandchildren. But when they're not there, how do you feel love? So you can, you know, it's a feeling. It's an emotion. It lives right here in your heart, and you just practice that over time. Mm. And you know, after that, it's just, you know, living this replacement self instead of the emotional self. You are living for your inspiration energy, and you're trying to follow your intuitions, and it leads to all these synchronicities, and you discover, wow, I have a truth to tell the world. How do I get that out? And wow. And suddenly you have this feeling, and then it synchronicity happens, and you go, oh my goodness, wow, the doors are opening. I can believe in this. I'm being helped with this, my mission of service in the world. You know, that's what we're all doing. And listen, and I'm not trying to put myself as a model. Mm-hmm. The reason I know this works is I can see people out there. And now more and more people are coming to a place where they can reach that. I'm thoroughly convinced.
So do you feel the vibration of the planet is shifting to that higher?
Yeah, I do, because people are asking these deeper questions right now.
James, thanks for continuing the good work, fighting the good fight.
Well, thank you.
It's great to reconnect with you, and thank Neil Gore for creating this platform, Portal to Ascension. People can find me at my YouTube channel, youtube.com/newrealities.
It's like a spacecraft landed in my backyard, with Alan on a camel and my man Bashar. 10 rabbis, a physicist, guru, and a genius. A woman who can teach you how to grow your penis. Shaman Steven is high as elves. NSA can't stop my elves. Fairies landed, whole world's dusted. Hugging under covers, butt naked in public. Governments bugging, but they're so corny. Back to the craft, first starborn orgy. What? It's new realities. Changing the news, new realities. God's interviews, new realities. Where do I begin? A left mention? J.J. Hertog, Keys of Enoch. Open up doors, teleport to Montauk. Navy ships disappear for battling. Duncan Cameron starts time traveling. Nassim Harriman, electron spin. Word I am word cell channeling. Paulo, masculine, feminine. Marianne Williamson, tears to triumph. Jade goddesses lift weights with their vaginas. Till there's a tantric holy glow. Jody Sirota's a UFO. From Sedona to DC, Washington disclose ETs. David Icke is like Adam and Eve. Meet me down a caravan of dreams. The realities, changing the news. The realities, God's interviews. The realities, Where do I begin?